This episode is brought to you by Square. If you run a restaurant or business, Square has the tools to help you stay connected to customers. Learn more at square.com/go/in the sauce. I'm Allison Kane, and welcome to In the Sauce, a podcast about building consumer brands from the ground up. I love doing this show because I get to interview everyone from production gurus to marketing and social media mavens, anyone who can guide me on this crazy journey. This is the story of building Haven's Kitchen sauces, but it's also the story of every growing brand because we're all in the sauce. Today, I'm speaking with Daniel Sklar, founder of Fine and Raw Chocolate, the Brooklyn-based raw chocolate company focused on sustainable ingredient sourcing and minimal processing. Daniel started Fine and Raw in a Williamsburg loft in 2007 after he left the finance world and got into the raw food movement. He opened a factory in Bushwick 5 years later, and today Fine and Raw Chocolate processes approximately 25 tons of chocolate a year. Companies like Ralph Lauren, Nordstrom, and Rag & Bone collaborate with Fine and Raw to create special edition chocolates. Welcome, Daniel.
Hello.
Hello. So are you at the factory right now? Are you making chocolate
as we speak? Yes. Yes. Well, I mean, I'm not making chocolate, but we are.
Yes. When I say you, I mean the royal you. Yes.
The royal us.
Right. So let's, so you're in Brooklyn, and how are you doing? And how are you weathering this pandemic of ours?
Oh yeah. I'm doing well. Thank you. We have been building out, the last, say, 16 to 18 months, we've been building out a new chocolate factory. So that 16 to 18 months felt like a mini crisis personal pandemic.
Right.
It's just really unfortunate that everyone else had to join our mini crisis personal pandemic. So anyway.
When did you move in?
We moved March 1st.
Oh, wow. So, yeah. So, you know, it's funny because you're doing well almost because you have this like fun new place that is like this thing you've been dreaming about for a year and a half, which can really fight against all of like the yucky feelings of being in the world at the moment. So that makes sense. Well, congratulations. That's fun. I would love to be in a new, fresh place right now.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, so let's back up a little bit. I know that you grew up in South Africa, and you lived there until you were how old?
Till I was 21.
Okay, so your whole childhood was there. And do you remember what you like wanted to be when you were 9 or what you aspired to? Clearly, you didn't think about being like a chocolate factory man, right? But were you interested in business or art? Or I've met a lot of people who wanted to be vets on this show, which
vets are very interesting. My uncle in law is a vet. I did not want to be a vet. When I was 9, I think I wanted to be a cross between Indiana Jones and Tony Hawk, probably.
Okay. I mean, that's fitting. Yeah. So when you had like an actual thought about like what you wanted to be when you grew up, when you were maybe a little older than Indiana Jones age, what was the plan? Did you have a plan?
Yeah. You know, I went to, I studied finance and economics, and my dad was an accountant. So he was sort of guiding me towards that path. That's what I thought I was going to do.
The last couple of guests I met, it's so funny. Sylvie's dad was a doctor, and so she was going to be a doctor. And, you know, I mean, everyone just kind of, I think a lot of food entrepreneurs, specifically food entrepreneurs, kind of find it as almost a second life. You know, they kind of do something that they're supposed to do or they should do. And then they kind of wake up one morning and realize, I actually don't want to be doing this anymore.
Yeah, completely.
Which sounds a little bit like what happened to you. But what I find interesting is that I read something about you. You won a green card in a lottery. Is that what? Is that a regular thing that happens in South Africa, or what? What kind of lottery?
It's a lottery. I don't think it's that common. Otherwise, they might have called it something else besides a lottery. Right. So it is. It is pretty rare. They do hand out globally. I believe there's 55,000 a year.
Wow! And what, you just put your name in because that was like, were you planning on coming to the United States any other way, or?
I had a really forward-thinking mom. And she applied for me when I was in high school because I have some family here. And right. One day I got back from high school and she says to me, hey, you want a green card to go to this date? And at that time I was not interested at all. I was more interested in what was for lunch.
Right. So, I'm sure.
But later on, you know, when I kind of got into university and started to study and think about what I wanted to do more, I was in love with the idea of either coming to New York or going to San Francisco.
Right. So you landed in New York and you worked in finance for a few years in New York?
Yes.
Yes. And then you had that moment that so many people have where you kind of woke up and realized you hated your life, or is that an exaggeration?
maybe it kind of, it's not, well, I think that, yeah, I realized it wasn't for me.
Right.
It was time to move on. At that stage, I think I was about 25.
Right.
I was calling it a quarter life crisis.
Yes, which makes sense.
Totally makes sense. And then I was also trying to take a positive approach. So I was calling it I switched over to calling it a quarter life privilege.
Uh-huh. Yes, that's true too. Yeah.
I know, very accurate.
Right.
And funny enough, that was circa 2006, 2007.
Right.
Yeah.
And I mean, chances are you might have had that crisis hoisted upon you a year or so later anyway,
exactly.
If you worked in finance in New York City and you were young on the totem pole.
Yeah.
So what, were you always in the kitchen growing up, or were you a food guy at all? Or did you kind of have that, you quit your job, you were kind of padding around the kitchen and you decided to start making chocolate?
Okay, I'm a total foodie. So,
okay,
in the sense that I was in the kitchen, yes, I was in the kitchen, but more to eat and to commentate than
and to make
to do any work. And then you know, when I left finance, I sort of had this had a plan, you know.
Okay. What was the plan?
Okay, the plan was very nebulous, I'll say. It did have a timeline.
Okay.
I devised 6 months of finances out. I was like, all right, great. I've got 6 months of finances. And to stretch that along, I ended up, as one does when you are not employed, you start making your own food.
Right, yes.
And you know, gone were the lavish days of being out at restaurants and living the high life of a financial analyst,
right?
And into the kitchen it was. And I just discovered this. It's just so much joy. There's so much satisfaction in making food and creating and working with your hands and all of that jazz.
Yeah. No, I agree. And so, I mean, it's interesting, right? Because I think a lot of the people that listen to this podcast tend to be, I think, younger than me, from my little research that I've done. And they're all sort of either having started or sort of starting to think about, you know, what they want to be doing. And should they go and start this thing that they've been thinking about? And for the most part, I don't know that a lot of people remember 2008, but, or at least, you know, remember it as an adult. But it is kind of interesting to think about 2008 in the context of today, right? Because I think, you know, I always kind of wonder why certain guests are at certain times, and it's not always intentional, but I do think that there's something really cool about your story in the sense that, you know, life didn't go exactly the way you planned it. And while you chose to leave that career rather than it choosing to leave you, something really creative and beautiful came out of some destruction, right? And yeah. And so you might have been, you might not have given this as much of a go if there wasn't sort of, you know, if jobs were hot and everyone had one and it was just, you know, the heyday. There's something kind of, I think, about the timing of all of this, which is really interesting. You know, I also opened Haven's Kitchen in 2012. And I know that's when you moved into your first like big factory. And I don't even know that I realized at the time how much a product of sort of that recovery everyone was experiencing at that time and how much people started to realize that they were forced into making their own food starting in 2008, 2010, and they got back into sort of artisanal things and crafty things. But even when the economy started picking up again, they still wanted to be touching something that felt authentic. And I think that's part of the chocolate story with you. Would you kind of agree?
Oh, 110% agree. Right. The word authentic really jumped out at me there. And that's sort of what people go for when you're sort of put in a situation that's not normal.
Right.
And you need to find your North Star again.
Right.
How do you do that? Well, you look for authenticity and relevance. And all, like, you know, all the spam and the noise,
everything, yeah,
yeah, just becomes so much more meaningless. Things that are authentic become so much richer.
Right. And I think we're seeing that right now. I mean, it's not a coincidence that the world is making sourdough and, you know, people are making their own washcloths. And, you know, I mean, everyone, there's just this, people want to touch things that feel real. There is a sense of control that's been lost. And, you know, making food and eating something where you know the story and you know the origins and you feel connected to it, I think does give people some sort of salve during, you know, times of uncertainty. And it's not like, it's not always uncertain because it always is uncertain. It's just that I think when the economy's booming and all of these great startups are happening and there's content all over the place and everything's, you know, everyone's got Instagram, everything's, then it kind of like hides the fact that there's uncertainty. And then, you know, sometimes it just becomes very evident, like in this case. So going back a little bit without getting too philosophical, when did you have your first sale? Like you were in the kitchen, you were puttering around, you were thinking about raw chocolate. This was still 2007. That's very early. It wasn't the Brooklyn chocolate heyday yet. And so when did you actually, that 6 month period was a time where you gave yourself to play a little bit, but when did you actually say, okay, wait a second, I actually am onto something here. And this is something that I might want to do as a career.
Yeah. So I spent, I spent a bunch of time traveling around and making food, and I became a chef, and I was sort of this gypsy type chef. And then I was living in this classic old school Brooklyn artist loft with a million roommates. And back then it was couch surfing and just a really colorful community. I was making chocolate in my loft. I would feed people chocolate and their minds would be blown. They were just, you know, this.
Right.
It was real. It was just like, yeah. Okay, these are cacao beans. They're raw. Even now people don't even know what cacao beans look like. When I show them to people, they take a look at them and they go, "Are those almonds?"
Right.
Like, no.
Well, if you've ever watched Dora the Explorer, like I have with my children, I actually know what a cacao bean looks like. Just from watching that show, which is, you know, neither here nor there. But I agree. They do look a lot like almonds. Sorry.
Totally. I had an amazing amount of support. And I think the pivotal moment was when my parents came to visit me from South Africa. And they flew into JFK and they came to my loft. And I sat them down and I brought out some truffles out the fridge, and at that time they were thinking, "Daniel, you're a crazy person.
Right.
You had a great job, and now you're making chocolate in your loft.
Right.
You know what's going on." So they tried the chocolate and absolutely loved it. They turned around and they go, "Okay,
wow,
you've got something. You should do this."
And so what happened between, because that was 2007 or 8, like that was still pretty early, or was that now a few years later?
No, that was 2007.
Okay. And so then what happened basically between 2007 and 2012 when you opened the first factory?
Okay. So I sold my first chocolate early December 2007 to a friend of mine.
Right.
A bunch of my friends were just sort of helping me develop the concept and the branding, and I sold a truffle for like $2.50 in quarters. And then brand officially launched early 2008.
And you're still making it out of your apartment, which pretty much not legal, but fine at the time.
Operating a little bit under the radar.
Yeah. New York was like that. It was very, you know, I think the reason why Brooklyn had the boom it did was just because, you know, people could do stuff and there was, you know, space to be creative. And I mean, Homa from White Mustache moved from California to Brooklyn because California was cracking down on her yogurt so much that she couldn't even make it. And she just came to New York and started making it instead. Thank goodness. But so you were making it and you were selling it. And were you making like actual sales for the, I mean, you had to have been because some, you know, the business took off.
Yeah, it really, so the way that it works is that if you're doing things organically, is that, you know, your friends are your first clients, and they support you because they love you and they're also into what you're doing.
Yeah.
Then there were a couple interesting things that happened. There was a supper club, which also, like in 2008, the supper club concept was sort of just taking off as well, and being picked up by big media channels like Condé Nast. And one of the big supper clubs, one of the notorious supper clubs, was my next door neighbor, Whisk and Ladle.
I remember.
So we were good buddies, and they came and they were like, "Hey, can we use your chocolate in one of our desserts?" And I'm like, "For sure, no problem."
Right.
And they took the chocolate to Bedford Cheese Shop up the street.
Yep.
And said to them, "We're doing a dinner. We want to pair this chocolate with a cheese." So they paired a chocolate, and the guys at Biffa Cheese Shop go, "Oh, tell this guy to come
to the sell store.
We want to carry his chocolate." All this really amazing pollination of the brand started happening.
Right. And did you have a website? I mean, Instagram did not exist at that point, I remember. So did you have a website, or word of mouth?
It was just word of mouth. I had a landing page, which was,
amazing. So Bedford Cheese Shop was your first like wholesale client.
Yes, they were.
And then how did it grow from there?
After that, I think the other big thing was joining the Brooklyn Flea. So, when the Brooklyn Flea first started out, I was like, all right, how am I going to sell chocolate? What am I going to do here? And I went to the Brooklyn Flea, and it was such a great vibe. Brooklyn Flea was really a moment in time.
Yes.
I mean, it still is such a phenomena, smorgasbord in the works. And it was kind of like me at the Brooklyn Flea, McClure's Pickles to the left of me, Moss Brothers to the right of me. We're all looking at each other like, what the hell are you people doing?
Right.
I'm like, what the hell are you people doing?
Right, because Mast was right on that street with Kula. Like, they were right around the corner from Bedford Cheese also.
Totally.
Right.
And so that was such a great way to get in front of people. And just to slowly start getting a feel for what it is to incubate a brand and to share your product with people, and then from there, I was on my bicycle going out to different stores, and they were very carefully chosen stores, stores that I wanted to work with, that I loved what they were doing, not too much unlike Bedford Cheese Shop, within their categories, very well curated, well thought out, authenticity, that's kind of the origins of the brand.
And then in 2012, obviously you had saved enough and made enough and felt strongly enough about the business to open a factory. And is that the factory that you just moved out of in March? Were you there from 2012 until this year?
We were.
And was the plan there just to make chocolate, or was it, I feel like you do have events there also. Was it to show people how to make chocolate? Was it just to have parties, to pay the rent? Like, what was the sort of business plan behind the factory other than making chocolate to fill accounts?
I'm so glad you went to the parties and the events. Cause that was definitely part of the grand vision. Make chocolate by day, party at night.
Right. it's so funny because whenever I talk to like entrepreneurship classes, I don't honestly know what's going to happen to New York retail. Obviously nobody does, but before this whole thing kind of happened, I would always say, if you want to open a bakery, great, open a bakery, but you still have all those other hours of rent that you're paying. So make it a disco, make it a library, make it if you're only using some of the day to earn money, but you're paying for the whole day, it's not a bad idea to try to make the whole day make some money. I guess if you are making enough in those 6 hours to cover, but most of us need many different sort of channels of revenue to make these things work. So that was the vision: make chocolate by day, party by night. Did you open it? Like, were people able to come see the chocolate being made? Was that part of the vibe or no?
Oh yeah, completely. The entire factory was glass and open plan. So you could come in. We had a small cafe in the front, so you could come in, get a hot chocolate or an espresso and a truffle. There was the glass. You look right into the factory. You could see everything going on. It was a truly magical space. And you would come in, the whole place would smell like you just walked into you're inside a giant chocolate brownie that just came out of the oven. And it would transport you somewhere else. Just the all the sensory aspects of it. Very, very, very special space.
And were you, just because now I'm trying to get an idea, so you were selling, were you selling directly? You were selling at the store, obviously, but were you selling online or not? Not yet, like not through
the- Oh yeah, no, we were selling online. Okay. Going back to my first website with the landing page, it had two pages, basically a landing page and then a buy page. 2008, and I put in some very bizarre shop plugin back in those days where, I found some very, very simple solution that I could plug in.
Right.
And then I think in 2008, there was a front page of the dining section in the New York Times. There was a mugshot of 12 Brooklyn food makers.
Yeah.
That to me, that was the pivotal, that was the turning moment for artisan food in the US, particularly in Brooklyn. And that day, my mug was on the front cover along with these 12 other characters. Right. And we were mentioned on page 6 in one little line. And we got about 109 orders that day.
Yeah.
I had never seen anything like that. So powerful. And that was totally amazing.
Yeah, amazing. So we're going to take a little break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about what the last 8 years has been like and what the future looks like. We'll be right back. This episode is brought to you by Square. As a small business owner, I know how challenging this time is for all of us. Many of my restaurant friends are pivoting into businesses we never planned on. If you run a restaurant or small business, Square has the tools to help you adapt. One of these tools is Square Online Store. It lets you set up a free online ordering page with curbside pickup and local delivery so you can keep customers safe. You can deliver orders yourself or integrate with delivery partners. Its Order Hub lets you manage all of your incoming orders in one place, no matter which delivery partners you choose to use. Square has all the tools to help you stay connected to customers, no matter where they are. See everything that's available by visiting square.com/go/inthesauce. I'm back with Daniel Sklar, founder of Fine and Raw Chocolate. Okay, so you were, it's so interesting to me because we had the same, I opened Havens in 2012 and it was a magical space. And for people that just want to create a place that sort of envelops other people in happiness, and deliciousness, there's nothing more satisfying. So at the time, you were selling to some stores, you were selling directly. Were the parties, in our case, we host weddings and private events. They're not my parties. They are a significant source of revenue for that business. Did you think of them that way? Were you having only parties for that were brand oriented, or were you renting it out as just an event space for people who wanted to have events there?
Oh, the majority was brand oriented.
Right.
I try and only get involved in projects that I feel. We did a lot of experimentation though. We did everything from art exhibits to yoga classes to social networking events. The majority of it though was brand focused.
Got it. And so that was sort of that worked. And then a big part of the business seems to be the partnerships. One of the things that really does stand out about you and Fine and Raw is that the packaging, it seems like you can just tomorrow, if I wanted to make something, you would just be able to make it. I don't know. I don't, maybe that's just how it feels, but it just feels like you're very flexible and you're very amenable to partnerships and working with other brands that represent them and you, but primarily them. Which I think a lot of brands are very much like, no, this is my brand and I can do like for you or X you, but I don't know. It feels like you're just much more open to those partnerships. How did that come about?
We are, thank you. That's a really nice compliment. That is something that we have always tried to do, develop really good partnerships with people. We're super flexible, we can turn on a dime. And I think that, you have to play to your strengths, right? Like you have to realize what your strengths are and what your weaknesses are. I love tinkering around with design. And so I get involved in design aspects as much as possible. So it's, the fewer people that are involved in a project, generally the quicker the project
goes.
Absolutely,
yep.
So if it's just me and Ralph Lauren or Juice Press or Rag & Bone or whoever it is, and I'm working directly with the designer and they're like, hey, let's do this. And I'm like, sure, cool. Like throw that together, send it right back. I don't have to send it to someone.
Right. And have a boardroom of eight people sit around. Nodding. Yeah.
Also it's the partnerships are, they creative and it's so fun to kind of get away from your usual production and do something that spices it up a bit.
Well, I have a question about that, right? Because if I was Ralph and I was like, hi, Daniel, I want to make a chocolate inspired by my new, spring collection, would you actually work on a flavor together and do a limited run of it specifically? Or would it be more like, we'll take this but change the packaging? Or does it depend?
We have done custom flavors. It's something that I try and not do, though.
Yeah, it's hard, right? I mean, inventory-wise and line time and all of that.
Yeah, no, it's the logistics are crazy. And then also it just, even from a creative point of view, the more creative decisions that have to get made, the slower the process, the less chance you get of taking it to the finish line. And flavor in particular is such a personal thing. It can be it's such a hurdle to get over. We do a bunch of flavors for people. We've done and we still do. We work with Grim Ales. We've done a bunch of beer truffles for them.
Right.
And a bunch of chocolate.
Right.
It
makes more sense if they're coming at it with an ingredient or with something specific that they're, contributing to it. Right.
Right. Right. Yeah. So true.
So once you moved in, so sort of after 2012, Brooklyn Chocolate, obviously there were others some of them have had more success than others. And it was kind of like this peak Brooklyn foodie thing, but you're still thriving and it's still going great. And you just moved to a bigger facility. So what part of the business would you say, whether this was intended or sort of a surprise to you, what part of the business kind of carried the other parts? Like what was the thing that kept you growing and reaching new people, you know, because it feels to me in a way like a lot of the other sort of Brooklyn chocolate brands have gotten quieter since 2012, but it feels like you've gotten louder.
Yeah, we're pretty slow and steady.
Right.
I think a lot of other brands kind of come off the blocks racing.
Yep.
And then there's a whole conversation about
money.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
Like, do take investment and then just go crazy, or get mad desperate, or just like, who knows that?
Right.
But throw rationality out the window as soon as you step into that whole equity arena, you know. So,
which leads to the question that, have you grown it organically, or have you had investors and raised outside money? And if you have, I'm assuming it's more just friends and family rather than like institutional venture backed kind of things like that.
Yeah. Right now I'm 100% owner of Fine and Roll.
Wow. Which is
amazing. A modern miracle, I would say. I use debt a lot.
Right.
I've built up really great relationships with banks.
Yeah.
I also have really good relationships with there's so many ways to finance things.
Yeah.
As long as you're patient.
So I think let's talk about that a little bit, because I think this is actually really going to help founders, because you know, the zeitgeist for the last several years has been, you know, you have a nugget of a business, you know, there's been venture money, a lot of it that kind of moved out of tech and into food and consumer, and a lot of people sort of willing to give you money to sort of make your dream come true. But obviously in exchange for that, they're taking a percentage of the business. And that is appealing, I think, in a way. It's also, you know, frankly, it's kind of hard for a new business with a great idea to just go and get, you know, raise debt. So they end up going to the venture funds and you know, they're more willing to take a bet a little bit because that's their business model, as opposed to a bank whose business model it isn't. But when you talk about ways to raise money, you know, things might not be so easy in the next couple of years. For people who are looking for venture money, private equity firms, et cetera, they're all sort of slowing down and valuations are changing. So it's not going to be as easy. So you've built it very organically and, you know, very step by step. So tell me a little bit about the debt process. You know, how do you go about it? Do you have different loans with different banks? Do you like lines of credit? Do you personally back them? Just a little primer on debt versus equity 101.
So I also want to mention that there are ways to finance things that you wouldn't actually realize are financing. So for instance, when I first started making chocolate, we were making chocolate with a what would be considered a co-packer,
right?
an amazing, totally amazing man, Michael Rogak. He is salt of the earth, runs a company called Joe Mart Chocolate in downtown Brooklyn. This dude is so Brooklyn. Like, you don't get any, but like, and heart of gold.
Right. And
we were making chocolate together. I would come in. I source all the ingredients. I bought a lot of the machinery. I oversaw a lot of the training, the techniques, the development. So right. not like a classic co-packer relationship where it's like a black box, you know, very right. much involved.
But at the end of the day, you were paying them for labor to make it as yeah. opposed to doing it on your own. Right.
Exactly. And then, so it's an expensive way to produce.
Right.
But it's a lot cheaper than equity or debt.
Right.
The other fancy thing to say here is that expensive debt is cheap equity. You get involved in real estate because you're renting and doing all these things this like really savvy New York real estate dude told me that once, and I was like, what does that actually mean?
Meaning that even if your loan has like a 12% interest rate, at the end of the day, it's still better than giving away X percent of your company.
Yeah, definitely.
Right.
And then it's so much easier to do things. Well, wow. So this is it's a tricky line to walk. It's a tightrope. Because it's, the people who I bounce ideas off and mentor me and guide me through things have always been like, you know, don't get into partnerships.
Right.
Do it alone. That's what I've done. I'm involved in another business right now. I have like a bit of a side hustle, and I have a partner there. Uh-huh. And now that I have that reference point and I'm working in a partnership, I kind of understand, okay, so this is what it feels like to have to negotiate through decisions.
Right. Well, you were saying you don't even need someone else in the room, you know, to you in a way, it feels like it's just creating static. You know, if the idea is there and two people are on, you know, either side, you can just bang it out and you can make a new chocolate flavor. You can make a new package. But when you bring more people into the equation, there's more that needs to be discussed. And there's, you know, people who are slower maybe to move. And that's all, you know, that adds weight almost to the decision-making process. In some cases, it's good because you know, they think of things that you don't, and they maybe analyze things a little bit differently than you do. But it can be an adjustment to have another brain that has equal say.
Completely. Yeah. And it could work out much better.
Yeah.
Potentially. Potentially much faster.
Yeah.
It's always, you know, double-edged sword, but potentially faster, potentially better, but the downside seems much worse as well.
Yeah.
So
you've moved into this new factory. And did you just grow out of the other one, or, you know, what's the plan for this new facility?
Yeah. We were busting at the seams there.
Right.
We've been trying to move for about 2.5 years. Real estate moves at a geological rock pace.
Right.
Like watching mountains move.
Yeah.
So the concept that we have right now is exactly the same as what we had previously, just way more refined. You come in, it's all glass, you can actually now walk halfway into the factory and you feel like you're immersed in the production space.
Right, that's very cool.
Yeah, it's super cool. The space is, it's got like 20 feet high ceilings and the skylights all over the place, so it's really well lit. The ambience is incredible. It is on the border of the real industrial area of Bushwick.
Right.
The semi-industrial area of Bushwick, which mm-hmm. is, which also has its such a electric energy.
Yeah.
The creativity here, you like get a sense for it on the streets, I think.
Yeah, that, for sure.
Yeah. I'm really excited for people to come and see it and experience it and just enjoy the space. And
so you're going to keep doing what you're doing. You're going to keep selling directly. Are you opening more accounts with stores? Like, are you trying to, chocolate tends to be a little bit regional. Are you thinking you want to be available nationally? Are you, you know, or is it more like in specialty shops?
We're kind of, you know, so Fine & Raw is a premium brand.
Right.
So you're going to find us in specialty shops and, there are a few grocery stores that you'll see us in, you know, like Whole Foods and Erewhon and Lessing's and like higher end grocery.
Natural.
Yeah, natural. Right now the business has moved online.
Right.
Is the world right now.
I know. I saw your spread, like the chocolate hazelnut spread. So I'll be purchasing that in an hour.
Oh, that's good.
All right. So I have to finish up because Matt, you know, starts to give me a eyebrow through the glass. And even though I'm at home and he's at his house, I can still see his face, which is a little disturbing. But in a good way, Matt. So last question, I guess, what do you wish you had known when you started all of this? And sort of as part of that, what do you think is your best advice to founders and future founders who have a dream and just want to make people happy?
What do I wish I had known? The people that you work with and your crew are the most important people. That's the lifeblood, the soul of everything. The second question was
best advice. Could be build a great team.
best advice is just be okay with making mistakes. Be lighthearted about it. Just be ready to bounce.
Yep. Well, Daniel, it was really nice talking to you. I really appreciate you coming on the show. Congratulations on the new factory. And as soon as we're allowed to, hopefully I'll get to come and take a tour. I know there's nothing more fun than literally visiting a chocolate factory. Matt, thank you so much for engineering from afar. Daniel, thank you again for coming on.
My pleasure. Thank you guys so much.
And I'll be back next week with another episode of In the Sauce. In the Sauce is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.